Before lecture chant? Sure. An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of Tathagata's words. Good evening, everybody. I hope everyone is doing relatively well, if not absolutely well. Ka-ching. As Michael said last week, we are very grateful to Norman for giving us a chance to reflect personally upon the Genjo Koan and to share our thoughts with our dear friends of the Everyday Sangha here and on Zoom. It really is such a joy to do this project together with Natalie, Marianne, John, and Michael. You know, as our little group, we discussed early on whether or not to chant the full text of the Genjo Koan for each of our meetings. We were worried about the amount of time that it might take up chanting through the whole thing. We didn't want to bore anybody, and we didn't want it to seem too repetitive. So we decided not to chant it each time. And then we met with Norman. Norman, of course, said how wonderful it would be to chant the Genjo Koan each time without knowing that we had previously discussed this. And suddenly, it seemed to us a really good idea to chant it each and every time. So it's funny how our fearless leader can allow us to see things in a slightly different way. I find that it's actually quite lovely to chant, and to chant in person and together on Zoom. Some of us in our priest group are chanting the Genjo Koan each morning, and it's a really beautiful practice. It's like poetry. Well, it is poetry. It's not like poetry. And what a wonderful way to start the day or to start the evening. Michael mentioned his fondness of Tassajara last week, and I share his fondness, having had the privilege of practicing there with some of our fellow Everyday Zen Sangha members with Norman in 2019, chanting the Genjo Koan periodically throughout the week and the months, as the early signs of dawn were breaking and the blue jays were starting to squawk and sing their many songs, you could actually feel the practice enlightenment in the bones, the actualizing of our mutual reality. As Norman and Michael have mentioned, this fascicle discusses reality on the relative level and the absolute, as many things in Zen does. It's, for me, the personal and the transcendental. Michael mentioned that in the first three sentences, you have the first statement that there is delusion and realization, practice, birth and death, Buddhas and sentient beings, something that we learn early in our Buddhist practice. And then in the second sentence, the negation of all of this, something also familiar to us from the emptiness teachings in the Heart Sutra. And finally, the last sentence, seemingly returning to the same place as the first sentence, but really slightly different this time, really leaping clear of both the personal and the transcendental, not worrying about either one, just practicing with concentration and wholeheartedness. And as Shohaku Akimura suggests, letting the hand of the grasping mind open and just letting go. Relative, absolute, and then letting it all go. This examination of personal and transcendental underlies the next section, which begins in our translation. When you ride in a boat and watch the shore, you might assume that the shore is moving. But when you keep your eyes closely on the boat, you can see that the boat moves. Similarly, if you examine myriad things with a confused body and mind, you might suppose that your mind and nature are permanent. When you practice intimately and return to where you are, it will be clear that nothing at all has an unchanging self. So I title this next section that I'll be covering today, Boats, Firewood, and the Moon, or the Self, and what I would call relativity, since just about everything we think about is relative to ourself. The self, impermanence, and no going backwards, and practice. The self, impermanence, and practice. Practice, the closest thing to enlightenment that I've experienced. Self, impermanence, and practice. Boats, firewood, and the moon. So indulge me for just a few moments. Close your eyes. And imagine that you are alone in a rowboat, being carried along by a slow current at night. You don't need to row because you appear to be moving already. You can hear the sounds of the water lapping up against your boat and against the shore. You hear the sounds of crickets. It's summer. The air is warm and humid. You can feel it like a blanket covering your body. You can smell the smells of a flowing river, slightly fishy, but in a pleasant way. You can also detect the scent of a fire burning in the distance, and you hear a slight crackle of the wood. You see the rippling reflection of the full moon in the water just in front of the boat, and it seems as though the boat itself is about to collide with the moon's reflection. Everything looks muted, a blue-gray, calm. Keeping your eyes closed, in your mind's eye, you look to your right and you let your eyes relax as the countryside drifts by. You're not quite sure if it's you moving or the shore. Of course, you know that it's you moving, but the shore does seem to move, like a painting on a scroll, someone slowly pulling the scroll from left to right. The boat has drifted closer to shore, and you look into the reeds alongside the boat to see, in the moonlight, fish darting around, and the grass gently undulating and swooshing underneath the boat. And since you have a closer look, your eyes confirm what you thought, that it must be yourself that is in movement and not the shore. But is that really correct? You can open your eyes if you like. In high school physics, I was taught that everything is relative. The speed of a train moving north can be described as 60 miles an hour with respect to the ground, or 120 miles per hour with respect to a train moving in the opposite direction at the same speed. So what is the correct speed? If we say we're only concerned with the speed of the train relative to the ground, then 60 miles an hour might seem like the correct answer. But that doesn't take into account all the people in the other train, or that the ground is actually shifting slowly under our feet. And to an observer on the moon, the train is moving along with the planet Earth, and the Earth is moving much faster than the train, and so forth. It's all relative. I think Dogen is telling us this. The ground beneath our feet is not fixed. Our bodies are not fixed. Ourselves are not fixed. And our bodies and minds are in constant motion even when we're sitting still. Have you ever seen a movie, maybe it was a rom-com, that started out as a normal scene between a couple having a heated conversation in a parking lot? And one of them gets really frustrated and upset and just screams, "Ah!" And suddenly, the camera zooms out as if reacting to the intensity of the moment, zooms way above their heads, above the buildings and the trees. And then you see a few city blocks, and then the city, and then a whole mass of land, and then the oceans, and then the earth, and the galaxy, and the universe, into vast, empty space. And then, while the camera is hanging out there for just a few moments, we see all of these things in constant motion, different directions, all a relative chaotic mess of kinetic energy. And we now know, thanks again to physics, that each and every celestial body is affected by every other celestial body in constant motion. And then after a beat, the camera starts to slowly zoom back in through the galaxies to the Earth, and then faster to land, to the city, past the trees, to the parking lot. And it sort of stops for a moment on the person, and then into the mouth, past the tonsils, down the esophagus, into the stomach, sloshing all around with millions of cells, sloughing off into the stomach, and glug, into one of the cells through the cell membrane, swimming past all the mitochondria, glug, plunging into the nucleus, getting smaller still, past orbiting electrons, and again, into vast, empty space. Then there's a crossfade back to the fighting couple and to the audience. And for some magical reason, also to the couple, whatever it was that they were fighting about seems really silly and insignificant. The egos that grasp seem insignificant to vast empty space. And even if we as an audience member first identified with one or the other couple in the fight, we see how ridiculous our taking a stand for one or the other person is, because neither one in the couple is really and truly absolutely in the right. No one ever is. One person's frustration is relative to the causes and conditions that have brought the other person to the point of a meltdown as well, and the circumstances that seem so important and catastrophic are not the big catastrophe that defines our lives, as our lives are much bigger than that, much bigger than we often concede. And this trick of the camera and animation that puts all this into some sort of scale reminds us, the audience observers, that there are many other catastrophes happening all around us. And yet, we all seem to continue in some way or the other. Somehow knowing that the absolute is really big, bigger than we can grasp, helps to put things a little more into perspective. Our practice helps me remember to do that. And as big as the absolute is, practicing intimately here and returning to where we are with the breath, it is also clear that everything is fine. And I can't be anywhere else or be anyone else other than this person right here. Remembering the relativity of our perceptual reality, and at the same time trying to come to terms with some huge absoluteness, it isn't easy. Waddell and Abe, in their translation of Genjo Koan, in the heart of Dogen's Shobo Genzo, point out that we can lose our grip on relativity by focusing too much and being absorbed too much by our own self. But by keeping our eyes on our boat relative to the shore and ceasing to follow only the external dharmas that we seem to be so involved with, we can realize that we and all dharmas are without permanent self, as Dogen says. And we thus awaken from the illusion that ourselves are permanent. If we focus only on external dharmas or only on internally created dharmas about the external world, in either case, if we focus only on those things, we can mistakenly cling to attributes of a permanent nature that are not really there. It's important then to keep in mind both the fact that there are internal and external dharmas, and realizing that the dividing line between these are anything but sharp, quite blurry actually. And we have to be ready to leap clear of the desire to distinguish between these two, actually, and just let it go. Right on the heels of reminding us that nothing at all has unchanging self, the very next thing that Dogen says is that firewood becomes ash. So we're going from the boat part to the firewood part. So this seems to me at first to be contradictory. Going from firewood becoming ash, it seems to reinforce the ever-changing self, right? The firewood is not going to stay firewood forever. It inevitably becomes something else. And perhaps ash is the ultimate becoming of firewood. After all, firewood is firewood because firewood is meant to be burned. And once burned, it turns to ash. Dogen says that ash does not become firewood again, and that seems intuitively obvious, doesn't it? There doesn't seem to be a way of recycling ash and turning it back into firewood, at least not yet. I think someone has figured out a way of creating a special ink and paper so that once something is printed in red, the ink can be somehow removed from the paper and the paper can be used again. That's pretty cool. Now I can read my actual newspaper and not feel guilty about it. But I think once you burn the paper, it probably wouldn't work, this method. So I think Dogen here is laying the first foundation for a close-up examination of birth and death and rebirth. And he is using his understanding also of time, which is a lot bigger than mine, to reinforce the importance of being fully present in our momentary lives, something we've heard time and again. The Ta-Nehisi translation says, you should understand that firewood abides in the phenomenal expression of firewood, which fully includes past and future and is independent of past and future. Huh? So in the translations of Waddell and Nishijima, the firewood and ash each has a past and a future, just like Ta-Nehisi translation, but the past and the future are translated as cut off. So all of this seems to be paradoxical. How can you have a Dharma position, let's say sitting in this room right now, sharing the same space, hearing the same words, feeling the same breeze, and having a past and a future? And yet, the past and the future are cut off. I think the paradox is answered by the next line, which in the Nishijima translation says, ash exists in the place of ash in the Dharma. In the Waddell translation, it says, ashes are in the Dharma stage of ashes, which also has a before and after. Just as firewood does not revert to wood once it is turned to ashes, human beings do not return to life after they have died. Okay. We are all at the Dharma stage of this very moment, in this very life. And that may encompass a great many phenomenal things, such as what my body is feeling, and what my senses are sensing, and what my mind is thinking, which of course changes from moment to moment. And perhaps the sum of all these phenomenal things equals a momentary or even a prolonged Dharma stage. I don't know, but I kind of get Dharma stage. And there have been myriad things that have taken place in my history of being alive on this earth. And those events, as well as the genetic and ancestral behaviors that have influenced how I manifest at this moment. And there are things that I'm doing right now in this life that will influence many other people in other Dharma stages for eons to come. So this is karma. I have a karmic past and a karmic future. Nevertheless, Buddhism tells me that I can still act on my own. I can continue to practice as I have faith that practice is a benefit in acting for the benefit of others, and that I'm not completely subservient to my karma. So where the past and the future are cut off, that is something that Norman has spoken of many times. We can't live functionally in the past or the future. If we try to live in the past, we would forever be beating ourselves up for mistakes that we've made, and I've made a lot of mistakes, and continue to do so at an astonishing pace. And reliving mistakes again and again is really not a lot of fun. And while you would think that there could be a benefit from reliving mistakes again and again, like coming up with a really good solution the next time when such a situation presents itself, the exact same situation in which we made the mistake is not likely to occur ever again in quite the same way as it did when we made the mistake. So maybe it's a good idea to learn generally from our mistakes, maybe to apply the learning from the mistake to a broader truth. And then, as Okamura says, open the hand of the mind and let it go. So not to live in the past. We can't live functionally in the past. We have to move on. And of course, the same thing applies to perseverating on imagined ways that the future will happen. Devising a million rationales and plans, and finally detailed mental constructions of what a future situation might be and how people might react, what people will do. And of course, it never quite ends up that way. We have to make plans, of course. That's how we shop for dinner and plan for our next trip. We do the best that we can, and then we move on. Even planning for our own death is something that we probably should spend a little thought about. Like, do we want to be buried or do we want to be cremated? But maybe not dwell on it every day. In dwelling too much on death, we could inevitably just give up on everything in this life, thinking, what the heck? I'm gonna die, nothing really matters. This mentality could really detract from doing some great work in this world. Whether you think it's great or not, someone else might be quite touched by the smallest kindness. On the other hand, if we didn't think at all about death, and we thought that we were somehow immortal, we probably wouldn't save any money. People wouldn't be very nice to each other. And there would probably be dead bodies piling up in the streets because no one planned for their ultimate demise. What does remembering that we're going to die have to do with being nice? Well, there's a wonderful saying, it's always good to be nice to people on the way up because you may meet them again on the way down. We need everybody's help because there's always going to be the way back down. Should I keep going? Yeah. Okay. Dogen then goes on to talk about reincarnation. My understanding is that in India, the idea of reincarnation as a form of rebirth is and was a widely held belief. Buddha apparently did not share this view, which isn't surprising. After all, to have reincarnation, you have to have a somewhat permanent self that transmigrates from the person who has died to the person who has been or is being born. And as Dogen just mentioned, one of the biggies of Buddhism is that there is no permanent self. But you may ask, wait a minute, Neil. The Pali Canon speaks about rebirth into different realms. Isn't that like reincarnation? I've always interpreted rebirth into the different realms as more karma, the rebirth of future generations, or personal psychological realms, our own personal hells and heavens that we spend throughout the day, not reincarnation into a literal hell, human or heavenly realms. I may be wrong, but I haven't seen convincing evidence to the contrary. The idea of reincarnation is kind of nice in that for those who believe in it, it allows them maybe to move on from mistakes in the past and gives the promise of a better future, particularly with atonement for a better future incarnation. On the other hand, it can also have the opposite motivation of no regrets at all at any unwholesome actions, because what the heck? Eventually, it'll all work out. And I'll reach nirvana eventually. Buddha doesn't let us off the hook so easily. What crystallized for me this concept of time, karma, firewood, and ash was an experience that happened recently. Actually, it was a whole set of experiences, profound in their impact on me and reverberating still. My husband Christopher's brother, Dan, had been diagnosed with prostate cancer for several years. He was in his early 50s at the time of diagnosis. Chris has three brothers and no sisters. Chris is the second oldest, and Dan was born about a year after Chris. Chris and Dan were pretty close growing up. Dan went to the Pratt Art Institute in New York and specialized in animation art. He never really got a long-term job in animation or in any profession, and he moved around a lot from time to time. He stayed for a bit with his mother in the Hudson Valley area of New York. But because of a conflict with the oldest brother, Dan moved out from his mother's house and he came out west. Dan came to live with Chris and me in our guest bedroom shortly before we got married. Dan stayed with us for about 6 months. We had some dinners together. However, Dan kept mostly to himself and spent much of the time away with his friends. A year or two later, Dan was diagnosed. He had also fallen on hard times during that period, and Chris had been quite concerned. Chris would visit Dan from time to time and help in any way that he could. However, again, Dan, who had been an intensely private person, had a strong sense of independence and wanted to maintain this. Chris and I set up a means of some financial help for Dan, and Chris helped Dan set up medical and social assistance. Early in this year, Dan's treatment began to fail, and his oncologist changed his treatment to a stronger one. In March, even that treatment failed, and the oncologist recommended stronger chemotherapy. Dan's pain had become quite severe, necessitating several trips to the emergency room and stays in the hospital to control it. There were metastatic tumors throughout his spine and around one of his kidneys, causing it to fail. Chris and I had just gotten back from Sangha Week in Tassajara in May when Chris received a call from Dan from the hospital. He had been admitted again for unrelenting pain. The oncologist had increased his morphine again and again recommended strong chemotherapy. And Dan felt that he would be better able to undergo the chemo with some help. 2 days later, we picked Dan up in American Canyon, about an hour away from us, and brought him home where he could stay in the same guest bedroom as he had been 8 years ago. He was very unsteady on his feet. And so we got a pair of trekking poles from the garage and Dan practiced walking with them. Chris and I got up to speed quickly with the help of a social worker, several visiting nurses, an occupational therapist, and Dan's oncologist. We gently discussed how far Dan wanted to go with treatment if it wasn't working. He also made it known that he wanted to be cremated, sensing that time was growing short. Dan and I reviewed his list of over 20 medications, I created a daily spreadsheet so he could tick off each dose as he took them. And he meticulously followed the regimen, much to my surprise. We knew Dan's cancer was very aggressive. It nearly doubled in size in the period of 3 weeks before Dan came to our house. Nevertheless, we were all planning on Dan staying for some weeks, and then with the social worker's help, depending on Dan's response to the chemo, we would find him an independent living situation in Alameda County where we lived, so we could continue to help him. Dan elected to undergo chemo, knowing that it was a long shot. We were in the process of trying to establish medical care for Dan in the Oakland-Berkeley area where we live, but in the meantime, Chris drove Dan up to Napa 3 days in a row for Dan's intense chemotherapy. We all braced for the worst following the chemo, but Dan seemed to be doing okay in the days afterward. We had stocked the fridge with various protein shakes, popsicles, juices, and a rainbow array of Gatorade. Dan enjoyed watching Netflix in the guest bedroom. He was easy to take care of and a pleasure to be with. The mood, the backdrop during this period of time, though, was heavy with uncertainty. Waiting for the shoe to drop and hoping for more time. In that second week, Dan took a hard left turn. He was sleeping a lot, eating less. One day that week, Dan had wanted to eat something in the kitchen, and he got there eventually, but his hands were shaking so badly, he couldn't get the spoon to his mouth. Chris and I and Dan somehow got Dan back to the bedroom, which was on the other side of the house. It would be the last time Dan was to leave his room. There was a flurry of advance directives, orders to be signed, and important legal papers notarized at bedside in the waxing and waning hours of consciousness. Chris and I learned how to change bed sheets, administer highly concentrated liquid morphine, and dose anxiety medications, according to how Dan's body was responding. Dan was not religious, but at Chris's request, a chaplain came and administered last rites. He was a large, kind man at the bedside in his collar, and I with my rakasu, chanting psalms together, and he sprinkling holy water. The visiting nurse had mentioned that once Dan stopped eating, it would be about a week. On that sixth night, Dan's breathing became labored, though interestingly, his body, which had been contracted and tight for several days, completely relaxed. Chris and I decided to take turns sitting by the bedside all night, in an overstuffed chair in the corner of the room with Dan. We had the windows open as the temperature outside was balmy and the breeze seemed to settle the room. The oxygen machine in the other room made a soft ch-ch-ch, ch-ch-ch. During my shift, I chanted the precepts, the Heart Sutra, the Enmei, over and over again until I fell asleep. I think I may have drooled a little on my rakasu strap. Morning came and Dan seemed the same. The morning dose of morphine and Ativan was given, and Chris and I did a few chores around the house. By noon, Chris's daughter Lydia and Lydia's mother were there to relieve us, as they had done for the past week. Chris and I hadn't had anything to eat since early the evening before, so we walked to College Avenue and ordered some food and sat down. Just at that moment, Chris got a call from Lydia that Dan had taken his last breath. We headed home, not in a rush, but not slow either. When we got home, we all chanted the Heart Sutra and just sat with Dan for a while. Though Chris and I weren't there at the exact moment that Dan took his last breath, it didn't seem to matter. The incredible journey that we all had been on together for that 3 weeks was much more meaningful to us than just a few seconds. And anyway, Lydia and her mom were there holding Dan's hand at that moment, and that was right. And who knows, maybe Dan was waiting for us to get the heck out of the house so he could slip away in peace. Enough with you two already, get out of here. 2 weeks later, Chris and I and Lydia and her mom arrived at the crematorium near the Oakland airport. The waiting room was very cold. When it was time to see Dan off, we went through the door into a very large industrial room with concrete floors. And there it was very, very warm. Two large metal enclosures were at the far end. We lit a stick of incense, chanted the Enmei together 7 times, and for safe passage. The heavy metal door to the oven slowly rolled up. You could see that every wall inside was glowing red. And in another minute, the door slowly rolled down with a silent clunk. Firewood. Ash. It is an established way in Buddha Dharma to deny that birth turns into death. Accordingly, birth is understood as no birth. It is an unshakable teaching in Buddha discourse that death does not turn into birth. Accordingly, death is understood as no death. Birth is an expression complete this moment. Death is an expression complete this moment. Life is an expression complete in each moment after moment. Firewood becomes ash, and yet birth does not turn into death. Dan is gone, and he's not coming back. The wonderful quirks, his goofy, infectious laugh, and his mischievous sense of humor were part of the complete and full expression of Dan in his Dharma stages of life. To say that Dan was born on such and such a day and died on such and such a day and was 60 years old and had cancer falls woefully short. The experiences of joys and trials and tribulations, the fun parts and the messy parts, were shared intimately. And during the moment-to-moment connections that came and went, and there was only that. Yes, there were annoyances, fears, and hopes, but these were secondary to what was actually happening in real time. The last paragraph of this boats, firewood, and the moon section is for me the most poetic. I love moon imagery in Zen literature. Dogen tells us in the first line of that paragraph that the reflection of the moon in water is like enlightenment. It really sets a mood and evokes a feeling of lightness. And since Dogen quite insightfully describes enlightenment as practice enlightenment, or maybe just practice, that moon water mirrored reflection is what we're doing here and on Zoom. It's the story of our lives. And in retrospect, those last 3 weeks with Dan were like the whole moon and the entire sky reflected in dewdrops on the grass, or even in one drop of water. The moon does not get wet, nor is the water broken. The practice, which was so present during that time for me, and I felt so connected to that practice, could not be broken. The depth of the drop is the height of the moon. It cannot be measured or described. Our support and love, which came forth, was the practice. And in the practice came forth all time and space, focused like a laser-like moonbeam in that guest bedroom. Practice enlightenment came with sickness and death. And yet, there is no sickness and death. Only caring, kindness, and love. Thank you for your kind attention. So I think we have time to split up into groups of three and talk about boats, firewood, and the moon. How does your practice bring relativity or a sense of proportion to your life? Or how does your practice help you in difficult times? So maybe 15 minutes, Jane, is that good? Okay. We'll see you when you get back.